language is one of those things that continually fascinates me, which is a bit unusual since I fared very poorly in every foreign language course I ever took. In fact, I can recall a deal I once made with a German professor back in my college days that towards the end of a semester, if he would give me a passing grade in the course I was taking from him, that I would never take another course in German again. It was one of those situations where I needed a certain number of credits in a particular language to get my degree, and I got about a course or two into German and realized that wasn't going to cut it. So we went back to square one and managed to make it through in Spanish. German professor, we each kind of lived up to our side of the bargain now. Now, my language fascination instead has to do with how certain words and phrases find their way into our cultural and societal lexicon, and then, more often than not, or at times anyway, become used as tools for driving, if not manipulating, public opinion. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the more well-used ones, like pro-life, pro-family. A little more recent vintage is one called Values Voter, and the like. And just for the record, since I'm tossing these terms out, I should say I happen to be in favor of life and families. And as I hope to demonstrate in a couple of weeks, I am a values voter, so is everyone, I would maintain, who casts a ballot in any given election for any reason. But given my wide range of opinions, or my opinions on a wide range of contemporary issues, I would most likely be cast as the enemy of all three of these stances by those who have captured the language for their own social, political, cultural purposes and ends. And over the past few years, and particularly in our post-9/11 environment, my radar here has picked up on another such term and tool when it comes to driving or attempting to drive public opinion. And the term is moral clarity, which is something I've long considered to be a good thing, and something I've long considered myself to be in favor of. I even like to think I possess a little bit of it, and now I'm not so sure. But this term, moral clarity, is increasingly being used as a rationale by the current administration and its defenders for the policies this nation has adopted, many of the policies anyway that we have adopted, in response to the threats and fears of terrorism, real as those may be. An early shot across the bow in this regard was the publication back in the fall of 2002 of a book by William Bennett titled Why We Fight, Moral Clarity and the War on Terror. Mr. Bennett, who is the self-appointed czar of our national morality, used this book with its title to advocate for, among other things, a preemptive strike on Iraq. Now, we fast forward for about 4 years, staying on this very same trajectory, and you come to a speech given this past August the 29th by Secretary of Defense Mr. Rumsfeld before the annual convention of the American Legion. And in this speech, Mr. Rumsfeld accused critics of the administration's war policy in Iraq of lacking moral clarity and of being morally confused when it comes to fighting terrorism. Well, it all set me to ponder. That's something I do a lot of. Less friendly term for that is daydreaming. I play my own little game with the language and say I don't daydream, I ponder. Here's what I pondered as I thought of the pronouncements of Mr. Bennett and Rumsfeld. We're nearing the 3,000 mark when it comes to American combat deaths in Iraq. I think we're up on the plus or minus side of 20,000 wounded. Depending on which surveys and reports you read, it's still several hundred thousand Iraqi civilians have been killed since the spring of 2003. That country is now destabilized to the point that it provides a base of operation for terrorists, where no such base existed prior to our invasion, and our moral standing and credibility of a larger world community has been severely diminished and compromised. So I further pondered that if this horrific and hideous set of outcomes is the result of moral clarity, and I would just as soon be morally confused. But I don't think I am. Morally confused, that is. I think, rather, I have enough clear-headedness to recognize that when a perfectly good and necessary attribute like moral clarity becomes falsely equated with moral certitude or moral absolutism, what you end up when you have that kind of equation, that kind of false equation set in place, more often than not, is not moral clarity, but moral blindness. And I think that's what we're dealing with right now. When it comes to our presence in Iraq, we're dealing with the outcome of a phony kind of moral clarity, the rapidly degenerated into moral blindness, and which has given us a morass we now find ourselves in the midst of. And some of our finest young men and women who love their country deeply and who willingly went forth to serve have paid the highest price for this kind of blind moral posture. Well, my position on this war is well known enough, both within and beyond this congregation, that for me to continue in this vein would be to carry the proverbial coals to Newcastle, so it's time to move on. And I offer what I have said up to this point, not to belabor points I've made before, but to draw in as strong as a way as I can what I just alluded to, what I think is a crucial distinction between moral clarity on the one hand and moral certitude or absolutism on the other. For true moral clarity calls for careful discernment. It calls for the weighing of various possible outcomes in determining what is in fact the most and the best moral and ethical course to take in any given situation. An unthinking kind of moral certitude or moral absolutism, on the other hand, assumes that one has the unquestionably correct moral position at the outset of any given course of action, and that such a course then has to be stayed, however misguided, tragic and hardly misguided on occasion, it may prove to be. Well, it was nearly 4 years ago, close to 4 years ago, that I offered a sermon here called Confessions of a Moral Relativist. Don't know how many of you caught that one, but it managed to generate a little buzz. In fact, I got a few requests from persons or organizations who maintain websites or blogs that deal with the role of morality and ethics in determining public policy and all that. I got a few requests asking if they could use it, you know, could we put that up on your website? Well, heck, I had my ego needs just like everybody else. So I said, yeah, sure, go ahead, put it up there. Just make sure you spell my name right. There's only one D in Eddington. Well, I'm going to revisit some bits and pieces of that sermon today in order to expand upon what I am putting out here, and to make the point that a heavy dose of moral relativity, by moral relativity, I mean making moral decisions relative to whatever situation they arise in. I think that's what's actually needed if one is going to possess a true and honest kind of moral clarity. Well, reflective of some of what I've said so far, though, I can well understand how in times of confusion, fear, uncertainty, the human need and the human instinct is to, in fact, reach for certitudes and reach for absolutes. That's very real. It's very similar in some ways to the more physical, primal instinct that causes a drowning person to reach for the security of a life preserver, for something that is sure, something to hold on to when life becomes uncertain or fearful. Thinking of that then reminds me of an inquiry. It came to me through our church's website several years ago. I believe I alluded to it in that other sermon. It was a very serious inquiry. It said, my best friend, who is a Christian like myself, is exploring his sexuality, and his search is revealing that he is gay. I don't know what to think. Could you offer, I'm hoping you can offer some guidance. I'm scared and confused, as I know he is. Could you possibly send me any text about what God thinks about people like my best friend. Yeah. My first take on this was to feel a little flattered that someone seems to think that I know what God thinks. She must believe I move in some pretty rarefied circles. But sort of getting past my reflexive humor there, I also knew that it was not my place, and I certainly did not want to make light of her concern. I didn't want to make light of the moral struggle this young woman was obviously engaged in, and so I answered as best I can, best I could. I'll tell you my answer a little later. Now, in television parlance, what I just did is called a teaser. Means you can't change channels. You got to stay tuned there to where I went. No mental channel surfing going on out there. All right. For now, though, let's just focus on what I took to be the keywords in that email note. I'm confused. I'm scared. What does God think? This person was sincerely seeking moral clarity on a matter which she says she herself was scared and confused about. She wants to know what God thinks. In other words, she is reaching, as we all do, I think, at times, for certitude in a time of confusion. As they say, who doesn't? Her final appeal, so to speak, is what God thinks. Looking, that is to say, for the moral bottom line in a real-life situation that is deeply affected. And what is the assumption? Whether this young lady consciously realizes it or not, what's the assumption behind her question? Well, it's the assumption, that our codes of morality, our codes of behavior, are all ultimately rooted in a source somewhere beyond human construction and human experience. It could be a deity, God, however conceived, could be what our Enlightenment ancestors, Thomas Jefferson, for example, called natural law. Whatever it is, it's something out there that needs to be accessed so we can be morally clear in here. That's a very common, very understandable assumption. Any of you who have raised kids, think about this for a minute. When did you not, at least at one time or other, reach a point of exasperation after running out of explanations to your kid to obey a parental command when they kept asking, why? Why do I have to do that? Why do I have to go to bed? Why do I have to get all that? And eventually, even what would you finally say, because I said so, and that's all the reason you need. Now, way back, in my pre-parenthood days, I made a promise to myself that I'd never say something like that to any kid of mine. It turned out to be one of the more easily broken promises I ever made to myself. Okay, if we start with that, it's not that big of a jump to generalize from this kind of common parental experience to the idea that morality itself must ultimately come from some kind of cosmic superhuman because I said so. There may be some debate over who or what this I is in the big I said so. But the idea that morality with a capital M derives from some kind of transcendent source beyond human beings is a very commonly held one. It's what you hear invoked whenever somebody talks about God's law. From this perspective, then, moral clarity comes from one's being in touch with this transcendent source, with the big I said so, as it were, and knowing what the will of the big I said so is. And to be morally confused and to be out of touch with such a will. And what about the fear, though, that maybe there's no such thing as a big I said so? This fear was very well put in a classic novel by Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. Ivan Karamazov says at one point, if God is dead, everything is permitted. Okay. I want you to walk with me now into what I hope isn't too deep of water, as I offer an alternative idea or point of view to that of Ivan Karamazov and his literary creator, Dostoevsky. This could get a little deep at times, but we can do this. I would first, though, point out gently to Ivan and his creator that history, right down to the present moment, is rife with examples of human beings acting as if everything is permitted while doing those very things in the name of God. Whether it's an Islamic-inspired terrorist flying a plane into a skyscraper or a homegrown Christian Aryan nation-inspired terrorist blowing up a federal building in Oklahoma City, these are but two examples of persons acting on the basis of their own absolute moral clarity that they were doing the right thing in accordance with the will of the God in whom they believe. I only say that to point out that moral clarity, just standing alone, unchecked and unexamined, does not in any way guarantee a moral outcome. This kind of moral clarity, unchecked and unexamined, in fact, is what leads to moral blindness. Well, pointing that out, staying with my imaginary conversation with a fictitious character, I would then direct Ivan and us to an essay written by the biologist, Dr. Edward O. Wilson, who at age of 77, still alive and well, retaining his post as a research professor in evolutionary biology down at Harvard, wrote this essay about 15, 20 years ago, titled it, The Biological Basis of Morality. The title contains his point, which says, moral values come from human beings. Whether or not God exists, ethical codes have arisen through the interplay of biology and culture. What he's saying, in other words, is our morality is a biological function and not a theological one. I may be a minister and consider myself something of a theologian myself, but I also happen to agree with him on this. He explains this by saying that there came a point in our human evolutionary process where some of our earliest human ancestors began to realize that we need to, if we're going to survive, we're going to have to figure out some ways of banding together and cooperating and protecting ourselves against the rest of the world out there if we're going to make it, rather than each of us trying to survive on his or her own wits and merit. Taking that idea, Wilson then has come with this idea that there is a trend, that this course of evolution produced a trend, produced something in our genes that has predisposed us to cooperative behavior. Or to put it another way, we don't just go around pulling each other off in a competition to survive. We figure we have to get together to survive. And this process, and this is what he calls the cooperation gene, the cooperative gene, in turn gives rise to moral sentiments and codes of moral and ethical behavior. And more often than not, these codes of behavior would then be attributed to a transcendent source, or source, like God or the gods, in order to give them their authority. That cosmic, because I said so, as it were. Now there's a downside to this process, which Wilson also points out and acknowledges, in that he says it leads to a very troubling kind of xenophobia. Xenophobia. Fear of those who are different, strange, or foreign. What he means by that is that cooperation mostly occurs within groups or tribes or nationalities who then define themselves and their well-being, often in opposition to other groups, tribes, and nationalities. So we are biologically, this is sort of the paradox. I don't know if he ever calls it Wilson's paradox or not, but this is what it is. We are biologically predisposed to cooperate on the one hand, but also to assert our personhood or grouphood or tribehood or nationhood on the other. And sometimes these two drives work against each other, and sometimes in very tragic ways. But Wilson wraps up his theory on a positive note by pointing out, we are of a single gene pool from which individuals are drawn into each generation and into which they dissolve the next generation, forever united as a species by heritage and a common future. This is where biology and theology, my theology, get kind of close. Because when I read those words, I realized they're very akin to something I say in a lot of the funerals. And and memorial services that I did. Pretty close to the beginning of those services, I say that there is an ongoing flow of life on this planet and in this universe of ours. And each one of us come out of that flow of life for a time. We have our individual lives here on Earth, and then in turn, in time, we go back into that greater, larger flow of life again. Individuals are drawn into each generation, into which they are dissolved the next generation. Wilson's words. And during this time we're here, we leave something of ourselves behind for the enrichment of others. And that's my concept of eternal life. That we're each and all eternally related, even beyond our physical lives here on Earth. And that's also the basis of my morality. That we are each and all eternally related. Our world as we know it has become a much more frightening and fearful place since Dr. Wilson put forth his ideas some 50 to 20 years ago. I can only hope that we can still catch something of his vision of a united species with a common gene pool. Would we, in this nation tribe of ours, terribly and horribly wounded as we were over 5 years ago, be as willing to inflict death and destruction upon the members of another nation tribe, however noble and high-minded and supposedly morally pure our motives were, if we could actually see the people of that other nation tribe in the kind of relationship Wilson describes? Not having such a vision, I would suggest, is what allows moral clarity to degenerate into moral blindness. Well, where does religion fit into all this? Since I'm putting out these ideas of biologists before a religious community. Well, here again, I get some help from the same guy. The same essay I've been using. Try out this line of his. The human mind evolved to believe in gods, not in biology. I thought that was rather candid admission from a world-renowned biologist. You see, we didn't stop asking those why questions just because we stopped being children. We took them to another level. Why am I here? Why am I living? How do I know what's right? How am I related to my neighbor, to my family members, to my community, to my nation, to my world? These are religious questions, and they're moral questions, that we're called upon to struggle with and to live out as best we can. To seek and attain moral clarity in the very best sense, then, is to pursue these questions with both trust and with humility. We pursue them with enough trust in our ability to determine and to act upon what is right, while being humble enough to stand corrected when we're wrong. To pursue these ultimate why questions honestly and thoroughly means looking at the truths that objective inquiry can disclose, as well as the truths that we find when we look into our deepest needs and yearnings of our own souls, when we truly seek to understand and relate to and in some way attempt to fulfill the deepest needs and desires of our own hearts, hearts and minds of our fellow human beings. Make one more pass at Dr. Wilson before I finish up. Religion, he writes, will possess strength to the extent that it puts into enduring poetic form the highest values of humanity. I like to think that's what we're trying to do here. To put into poetic form the highest values of humanity. I speak not only of the poetry of our words, beautiful as they are, when you hear a hymn like you did, or an anthem like you did this morning. So I speak both of the poetry of our words as well as the poetry of our deeds and the poetry of our lives. We must always remain open to the truths that the natural world, as well as the world of people and ideas, holds before us. And if there is a bedrock basis for morality, if there is a true and honest beginning point in the quest for moral clarity, would cast my lot with Wilson's assertion that we are forever united as a species by heritage and a common future. From the self, to the family, to the neighborhood, to the congregation, to the community, to the nation, to the world. The kinds of moral behavior that is necessary and that will save us as a human species if we already need to be saved is one that will proceed from this notion that we are forever united as a species by heritage and a common future. Well, how'd I answer the young woman asking about her friend's sexual orientation? I guess I've got to make good on my teaser before I finish this up. Even though I know those of you who've been listening to me over the years have probably figured it out already. Anyway, I said, first of all, that sexual orientation in and of itself is not a moral issue. It's sexual behavior. And the moral choices we make about how we live out our sexuality that is the real moral challenge. And that moral challenge is one that needs to be based on respect and care and love. And as for the business about what God thinks, well, I wrote 12. I really don't know what God thinks about what you're asking me. My understanding of God is really that of a life force or a spirit or of a power within ourselves, similar to what Ralph Waldo Emerson called the spark of the divine, that he believed resided in the souls of all people. I believe we have this power within ourselves to draw upon as we make moral choices. And we should be willing to have those choices examined by others whom we know and love and trust in the most. That was about all I could do. Like I said, I figured you'd be able to guess what I said anyway. So to conclude, if Dr. Wilson is right, as I believe he is, about our sense of morality being an inherited and innate human trait, we're still left, as I've been saying, with the task of making moral choices and pursuing moral clarity and guarding against the moral blindness to which each and all of us are prone. And so one of our many tasks here as a religious community is to provide a setting, to provide a safe and discerning place wherein we do not have to make those choices in isolation, where we have the support and the interaction of others in resolving the dilemmas and decisions that confront us. It is because we share a common future that we need these kinds of communities of moral and ethical decision making. A place where, in the words of Alicia Carpenter, we may celebrate and cultivate a mind that's free to seek the truth, a mind that's free in age and youth, to choose the path no threat impedes, wherever light of conscience leads. These words are contained in our closing hymn. It's number 300, With Heart and Mind. Let's sing that.